Page 22, they go through a lengthy description of the typical alcoholic, which is not that easy to identify with, but because it's the person who brings everything down all in one night, you know, everything goes. But I'll tell you, we are lethargic people. Undereating and overeating creates the same sense of slow motion. We can't move easily the more we are into our addiction. And so, whereas alcohol appears, even though it's an anesthetic to most people, it appears to be a stimulant to a lot of alcoholics. Food is a depressant. I mean, it has that effect on us. Either eating too much or eating too little slows us down. We don't move quickly. So, if you took the description that begins on page 21 in the middle and goes on to page 22, and you imagined that your life, that a month of your life was filmed. Film, you've heard of film, it's different from digital, but you know what I'm saying. If for 1 month, there was a video made of your life, and then you speeded it up to take a day, you would see the same person. You know, I might eat like a pig one night and 5 days later do something absolutely disastrous. But if you speed it up, that would be 5 minutes apart, 20 minutes apart. You know what I'm saying? So that might help you. At any rate, page 22, right in the middle. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle, catastrophe, with all its attendant, consequential suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay in the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Next paragraph is significant. Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We are not therapists. We're not looking for the answer, the reasons, the cause. We have a solution. That's what's important. So we should not sort of try to do any self-analysis. There's a solution out there, do it. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol whatever into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense. I think that means this. Body is saying more, 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 and the mind is saying, I can't control my body. I give up. It's like I can't stop from blinking, I can't stop from my heart beating, I can't stop from breathing. Something happens both in the bodily and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. So we've now dealt with the allergy of the body. We're now going to embark on a journey exploring the obsession of the mind. This is the mind that keeps giving us permission to go back even when we've been away for a long time. It's what explains why we relapse. It explains why we keep going back even though we know we shouldn't and it will kill us. That once, even though we know once I start I can't stop, I still can't stop from starting. Because this is what the 12 steps give you recovery from. This is what the 12 steps stop. They stop the mind that says, okay, I'll have some. So let's analyze that, and now they're beginning to do that. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend, top of page 23, if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. I'm allergic to peanuts, why would I eat peanuts, right? I mean, it's obvious. I'm allergic to ice cream, why would I eat ice cream? Because I want it. Because. I mean, ultimately it's because. There's no other answer. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility. They have some understanding. But none of them really make sense in light of the havoc, the destruction an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself in the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious, false reasoning to the attention of the alcoholic, he'll laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they're satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. An obsession is an idea which takes control of the mind and pushes out all other ideas. That's the obsession. An obsession is an idea that takes control of the mind and excludes all other ideas. The obsession is found, it's the second, page 23, in the paragraph beginning "Once in a While," which is almost in the middle, it's the second last paragraph. Page 24, right at the top. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Doesn't work. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, we don't know why, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us, to stop us. If these thoughts occur, they're hazy and readily supplanted. Supplanted is replaced. I'm getting old. It would have taken me 10 minutes to get that. I need young minds. They readily supplant and replace with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. I don't know about you. Well, I'd never put my hand on a hot stove, to my memory. But if there are native Californians here, you will not understand this. But many people come from northern states here, for reasons that are obvious. And I only once ever put my tongue on a windshield at 20 below. Only once. Because what happens is it sticks. And you can't take your tongue off without tearing off some flesh. I've never done that more than once. I knew. You don't do that. It hurts you. But I have eaten. I've accepted reasons that make absolutely no sense for going back to the food on my diet. And we have another problem as compulsive eaters, and that is that almost every diet, every weight loss program, every book you read or anything like that promises you that once you lose your weight, you can eat like normal people in moderation. So there's the weight of these all these easier, softer ways that say, you can have a bit. Plus, there are all the stupid reasons we give ourselves. So it's tough. It's a much tougher area. Page 25. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, this is a description of the steps, which the process requires for a successful consummation completement. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, not was being solved, not was working, was helping a bit, had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools, the steps, the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And someone pointed out once, you know what? In order to pick up something laid at your feet, you have to kneel. Mm. Kind of interesting when you think about it. We have found much of heaven, and we've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. I'm going to pick up that fourth dimension when we talk about step 11 and intuition. The great fact is just this and nothing less, not nothing more, but nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, towards our fellows, and towards toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. I know that people would read that into our hearts and lives, But Bill had a thing about using the same word twice in the same sentence, so I say lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. You notice the asterisk there. Footnote. Fully explained, Appendix 2. Two more pages, there's another asterisk. For amplification, see Appendix 2. On page 47, there's another asterisk, and it says, please see Appendix on Spiritual Spirit. Now, that's found on page 567 of the 4th edition and 569 of the 3rd edition. So 567 for most of you. And it's an appendix. And if you'll forgive me, the appendix has never been taken out. Think about it.
Is that the new joke?
That's not the new joke. I got a much better new joke. But one of the things I heard once years ago from a comedy review is, I may not stop the show, but I sure do slow it down. Now, this appendix was put into the big book in its second printing. The first printing didn't have it. But they react, and there were only 5,000 copies sold of the first printing, and then it was reprinted in 1941. With this appendix, one story was taken out, and step 12 was changed slightly. And it was changed as a result of what they write about. They say the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that, now they're going to, this is the generic, the bottom line definition of what a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening is. The personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested, shown itself among us in many different forms. So that's a generic. It's not God is in me, or it's not like I suddenly see the hand of God and everything that happens. It is I have had a personality change sufficient to overcome my addiction. And that's important for me as a very, very skeptical agnostic to know that I don't have to have found the kind of God that other people find in this program to have recovered. My recovery comes from a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from compulsive eating. And that's what it is. And then they go on, they say, I'm going to summarize this. Our first edition, our first printing, gave the impression to many people that these personality changes must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. This is Bill, you know, I'm on a mountaintop, the wind is going through me. This is someone saying, who are you to say there is no God? Here's this in the, you know, something springs up and life has changed. These are all these amazing experiences that were described in the stories and in part of the book, in the big book, these sudden spiritual conversions. It's the, you know, in the preachers, it's the heel, you know, and suddenly, whoa, you know, I mean, I don't make fun of that. I'm just saying that it's like that. And what they're saying is, that's what we gave you, but that's not the majority experience, or the experience of the majority of people in AA. and remember, Bill said, God comes to most men gradually, but to me he came suddenly. So they go on in the third, the bottom paragraph. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James, in a very great book called Varieties of Religious Experience, calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realized that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. I mean, it's all in here. His reaction, not that life has changed for him, but his reaction to life has changed. That such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months, that's how long it takes for the educational variety, not years, not don't do step 4 until you've been abstinent for a year, not none of this sort of wait until you're really, 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 really ready to have God remove your defects of character in step 6. Do those steps, just do them. And within a few months, you will have a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive eating. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. Turn the page. Second last paragraph. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Oh, I'm sorry. most emphatically, paragraph above that, most emphatically we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. We'll talk about that shortly. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There's a quote from, well, it's not from Herbert Spencer, it turns out. It turns out from having been a quote from a clergyman named William Palin, but who cares other than big book thumpers. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation. That's really important. It's important in our lives, not just in here. All right, back to the big book. I'm going to break, let's see. When did I say I would break?
10:45.
Pardon me?
10:45.
At 10:45? Yeah, okay, good. So I'll break around. So we have another half hour. So we looked at that asterisk. On page 26 is the story of Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard was a very wealthy American businessman. And he just drank and had all kinds of problems. Came from a wealthy family. He went to therapy. There are some discussions of how long he was in therapy in the United States as opposed to in Europe. It's not really important from our point of view. At one point, he goes to Vienna and asks Sigmund Freud to psychoanalyze him. Freud says, I'm too busy. He goes to Alfred Adler in Vienna. Adler says, I'm too busy. He ends up with Dr. Carl Jung in Switzerland, who had broken with Freud and Adler, and I'm sure there are people who know this much better than I do, who had broken with Freud and Adler on issues relating to spirituality. Adler and Freud had more sort of sexual drives as being the problem, and Jung had more spiritual, lack of spirituality. Anyway, he went to some form of therapy with Jung. Some say it was very long, and some say it was relatively short. But whatever it was, when he went through that therapy, he thought that he had got to the essence and core of his being, that all his issues had been dealt with, that he no longer would drink, and he began to drink on his ride back to Paris or something, or to whatever port he was catching the ship on. And so he goes back to Carl Jung, and he says, what happened? And Carl Jung says this, he can tell me the truth. And this is what the doctor says on page 27. You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a bang, a clamp. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Oh yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these appearances are phenomena, the plural of phenomenon. These experiences are occurrences for which I have no explanation. I don't know how it happens, but they happen. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. So things are moving around in this personality. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which are once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly, but we know from the appendix of the spiritual experience, it's not necessarily suddenly, are suddenly cast to one side. And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employ are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. So Roland says to Dr. Jung, but I'm the deacon of my church. I believe devoutly in God. Isn't that enough? And Jung says, no, it's not enough. You need something in your heart, not in your mind. Now Roland goes back to the States, and he discovers a group that was known for a long time as the Oxford Movement. It became known later on as Moral Rearmament when Oxford University and the Catholic Oxford... No, it became known as the Oxford Groups because the Catholic Church had the Oxford Movement and Oxford University. They both asked them not to use the word Oxford. And so they renamed it Moral Rearmament. At any rate, it was set up by a man named Frank, it developed around a man named Frank Buckman. He was a minister, a Presbyterian minister out of Pennsylvania, I think Philadelphia, might be Pittsburgh, I can't remember, who had been very devout and broke with his congregation, and a real horrible break. They wouldn't do what he wanted them to do about setting up some kind of center, and he left them, and he was angry, and he went to England to cool off. And he was in Oxford. He began to read and think about his life. He began to realize he had lost his connection with Christ. He lost it. It just wasn't there. It wasn't visceral. It wasn't in his heart. And he wrote to his church and apologized for what he had done. And suddenly that connection came back. And he had a spiritual conversion. So he began to think about what he had done and sort of read books on this and came to the conclusion that one path to a spiritual awakening was the path of analysis, self-analysis, sharing with another human being, and making amends for the harms that you have done. It's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And so he developed, around him began to develop this group of people who followed him in this. They had all kinds of fascinating characteristics, and the history of the Oxford groups is absolutely fascinating. They did self-analysis, they did their own inventories, they did other people's inventories, they prayed all the time. It was a huge movement. It was concentrated for the most, it was concentrated on the in the Protestant side, because Catholics had their own method of confession and restitution. Well, not restitution, but they had their own sort of approach. And what the Oxford groups did was they'd go to a town and they'd get all the ministers and business people. It was pretty middle class and upper class in its approach. They'd get them sort of infused with this fervor of trying to go back to first century Christianity, they called it, the whole apostolic method of just, you know, the joy of being close to their God. And Roland became a member, and he did. He got honest with himself, he got honest with another human being, and he made up for the wrongs he had done, and he had this spiritual awakening, and he never drank after that. Never joined AA, he just never drank. Into his life come two Oxford group members who had been talking to a man named Ebby. I love their names, Shep and Sebra. And Ebby came from a very rich family. They used to summer in East Dorset, Vermont. And he had been sent actually to their summer home to paint it. They thought that'd be fair to get him away from drinking. It didn't get him away from drinking. He was so drunk at a certain point that he saw that, I don't remember what it was, but there was some insect or maybe some bird had sort of made a mark on the inside wall. He took out a shot, no, on the outside, so it was a bird. So he took a shotgun and, you know, shot the wall of the house. He got so drunk that he drove his car right into the kitchen of the neighbor, got out and asked for a cup of coffee. You know, I mean, it's that kind of character. And he was about to be committed by either Sebra's or Shep's father, who was a judge. But Sebra and Shep had been talking to him about the Oxford groups, and he showed some interest. So they went to Roland and said, you were drunk, aren't a drunk anymore, can you talk to Abby, can you sort of say to the judge, I'll take him under my wing. And Roland did that, and Abby got honest with himself, got honest with another human being, made amends for the wrongs he had done. And then the other part of the Oxford group's ideas were, you have to help people without thinking of property, prestige, or something else. It'll come to me.
Power?
Yeah, power, property, prestige. Exactly, that's what it was. Power, property. Thank you. And then Abby thought of his friend Bill. His friend Bill lived in East Dorset when they were kids. They were kids together. Every summer, he and Bill would reawaken their friendship, and they played together the whole time. And they would drink together as they got older. And he thought of Bill. And he's the guy who came to carry the message to Bill. And that's the way it all sort of brings together. Now, Dr. Silkworth knew the problem. That's step one. This is all from Jill and Charlie. He knew the problem. Dr. Jung knew the solution, had no idea about how to create that solution in other people, but he knew the solution. He didn't know the problem. He wasn't a doctor, so he didn't understand, or he was never given this idea of the allergy of the body. But he knew the solution. He knew exactly how to stop drinking for the alcoholic. He had no idea how to do it. He was never successful. The Oxford groups had this solution. So step one is, in a sense, Dr. Silkworth. Step two is, in a sense, Dr. Jung. And steps 4 through 12 are the Oxford groups. And it's a marvelous thing. And at all moments, Clancy's talk on the thin threads that kept AA together, he all talks about all these different moments in time when it could have just blown up and it didn't. What if Ebby hadn't spoken to Bill? What if Ebby had gone back to a bender? Because Ebby did eventually. He hardly ever got sober. His last 2 years were sober. He was living in a dude ranch in Texas run by some AAers, and they kept him sober. But he didn't have there was a moment, 4 or 5 months maybe a year, where he was sober and could carry the message to Bill. Bill wrote to Carl Jung just before Carl Jung died, 1961, and thanked him for the role that he played, sent him a copy of the second edition of the big book. And Dr. Jung said this, I love to read it. It's not easy to parse this, but it's well worth reading. This is the letter that Lois framed that was in the pictures that I passed around yesterday. "Your letter has been very welcome indeed. I had no news from Roland H. anymore and often wondered what had been his fate. Our conversation, which he has adequately reported to you, had an aspect of which he did not know. The reason that I could not tell him everything was that those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I had found out that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus, I was very careful when I talked to Roland H. But what I really thought about was the result of many experiences with men of his kind. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness. Make it spiritual hunger and it's perfect for us. Expressed in medieval language, Middle Ages, the union with God. How could one formulate such an insight in a language that is not misunderstood in those days?" So this spiritual hunger, spiritual thirst for wholeness, that's our problem. We're not whole. We're not whole people. I heard Blaine talk about, there's a God-sized donut. There's a God-sized hole. I'm sorry, not donut. There's a God... There's a God-sized hole in my heart. A God-sized hole in my heart that can only be filled by God. Yeah. The reason I said donut was in the AA 12 and 12 in step 6, they say, why should I get rid of my defects of character? I'll be like the hole in the donut. That's why I said it. So he goes on, he says, the only right and legitimate way to such an experience, this spiritual awakening, is that it happens to you in reality. And it can only happen to you when you walk on a path which leads you to higher understanding. So you have to walk in a path, you have to search for this wholeness to be filled. You might be led to that goal by an act of grace or through a personal and honest contact with friends, those things that happen to you. This sudden moment where you suddenly have this amazing feeling that the world is okay, or that I now place myself in the hands of my higher power. Or someone might contact you or have this personal thing that you suddenly you realize what love really means, or something like that. Or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines, the boxes of mere rationalism, thought, or reason. So you have to sort of, either it has to happen to you, or you have to walk in a path where you go beyond reason. You go beyond thinking. "I see from your letter that Roland H. has chosen the second way, which was, under the circumstances, obviously the best one. Jose says, I am strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in this world, evil principle that exists in this world that is winning, leads this unrecognized spiritual need, this need for wholeness, into perdition, into hell. Okay? So if you don't recognize it, you're going to hell. If it is not counteracted, met, by either by real religious insight, that's a spiritual awakening, or by the protective wall of human community, people protecting you from this sense of lack of wholeness. An ordinary man not protected by an action from above and isolated in society, so you don't have spiritual awakening and you aren't, and you're isolated in society, cannot resist the power of evil. Think about what a 12-step fellowship provides to us all. Real spiritual insight and a protective wall of human community. And that's why the 12-step fellowships work. Got both of them. Two for the price of one. And he goes on at the end, he says, you see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus. It is, spiritus. And you use the same word for the highest religious experience. Spiritus is spirituality, is God, is as well as the most depraving poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus, spirituality, contra spiritum, against alcohol. So, it's really a wonderful thing. So I'm going to go on, and we're going to go very quickly through the chapter that begins on page 30, the chapter more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. Remember, they've defined real alcoholics as being different from a moderate or a heavy drinker. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain, futile attempts to prove we could drink like other people, which is what all the diets tell us. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control the amounts and enjoy, even if it's only half a scoop of ice cream, his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we have to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. If you don't take that first step or understand that first step, that you're hopeless. If you're like me, you're hopeless on your own. You can't stop once you start, and you can't stop from starting, you're done. It will only get worse, it will never get better over a period of time. The delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Very violent language here. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever controls, recovers control. The end of that paragraph, we are convinced to a man and woman that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And I know you've heard that phrase, my illness is doing push-ups outside the rooms of OA. It's going to be stronger. If I ever go back, it's going to be harder. You know, people say, I know I have one relapse in me, but I know if I have any recovery in me. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We're on page 31. We have tried every imaginable remedy. And they go on, page 31. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing an inability to control his drinking can do the right about face, the meal to return you, and control his drinking, and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. And that's why, you know, we should be saying to people, if you don't think you have our problem, and you think you can eat moderately all those things that you know you can't, God bless you. Go off and do it. What do you need us for? We're here for 12 steps. That's our job. But if all you want is a therapy group, there are other therapy groups. There are other support groups dealing with food. Some of them are non-profit, and they're really good. And actually, the membership of TOPS, Take Off Pound Sensibly, which is much more reasonable. They no longer have the pig that used to go oink oink at you when you weighed yourself in. They have a larger membership in North America than OA does internationally. And it's a support group. Whether it works or not for people, well, it wouldn't work for me. Because I have more, I need more than a support group. But for some people, it works. Some of the way in pay programs, you just need to know how many people. I would meet people in the weight loss program I was in who would say, "Oh, the size of a hockey puck. That's all the protein I need. Oh, I've been eating, you know, 16-ounce steak. I only need 4 ounces." You know what I mean? Like, some people need to be educated about what's reasonable, and then they're reasonable. Or they gain weight, they say, "Well, I'll just stop eating a bit more. I won't eat as much as I've been eating, and I'll lose weight." You know, so there are all kinds of people who can benefit from things that OA doesn't provide them. And those people who come to OA thinking that's what we're here for are sorely mistaken, and we're not doing a very good job of explaining who we are and what we're here for so that the people who come can actually literally weigh us down. So that's not the joke either. But anyway, it's page 31. They're going to give us two tests for whether you're an alcoholic. Right at the bottom, we do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic. You can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It won't take you long for you to decide if you're honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. They then provide the first of four examples, four stories. First one is a man of 30 who was doing a lot of spree drinking. He decided he would quit drinking because otherwise he would never make money, he would never feed his family. And he stopped. Tremendous willpower. For 25 years, he did not have alcohol. He was able to retire at the age of 55, which in the 30s is just amazing, right? Because of the depression. Out come the slippers and a bottle. And he dies in 4 years. He can't stop drinking. And they say on page 33, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. Every diet tells us that. Or many diets tell us that. We've seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind or any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol, physically immune. The next two paragraphs are addressed to youth and to women. They do their best. Within the context of their experience, they do their best to say, young people should discover this before it gets as bad as it was with us. Women might have different experiences, but they can be real alcoholics too. Okay, they do their best. Just give them some credit. For those of you who read this patriarchal, slightly misogynistic book, it was of its time. And they did their best. That's all I can say. Forgive them their problems, you know. They did their best. Then they give another test, page 34, almost in the middle, just above the second paragraph. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Can you remain dry for a year? That's the mental obsession part. The allergy the body is, can you just have two drinks in a bar and stop? And you have one scoop of ice cream and stop? Well, I know I can't. And the next one is, can you remain sober for 1 year? And if the answer to that is no, you're a real alcoholic. And they go on. How then shall we help our readers determine, right at the bottom, page 34, to their own satisfaction, whether they're one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede, that go before a relapse into drinking. For obviously, this is the crux, the core of the problem. So the real problem is, what happens, why do we go back? What is it that sends us back to it? And they're going to give some examples. I love this next paragraph because it's so well written. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Isn't that well written? The desperate experiment. Well, I'll have just a little bit. I don't know how many times I've said that, and I don't know how many, and you only know how many times you've said it. First example is Jim. This guy is a drinker. He inherited a successful car sales company. He lost it all because of his drinking. He resurrects himself, goes to AA, and he makes a beginning. It's not clear how far he goes, but he doesn't go very far in the steps. He gets a job back at the same place that he used to own. He's not a happy fellow. On page 36, he comes to work on Tuesday morning, and I know Joe and Charlie, oh, Tuesday morning, where was Monday? No, he hadn't started to drink yet. But he hadn't started to drink yet, so to be fair, I think Joe and Charlie are not correct here. But he was irritated, and he has some few words with the boss. It's not a good day for him. He's really restless, irritable, and discontented. He decides to drive to the country and see if he can sell a car to someone. On the way, he stops by at a roadside place where they had a bar. But I'm not going to drink. I'd gone there a lot of times. And he orders a sandwich and a glass of milk. And then he orders another sandwich and a glass of milk. And suddenly, on page 36, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured into the milk. I vaguely sensed that I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. I mean, how absurd. But it seems reasonable to him at the time. I don't know if you've ever heard John Kay, the wonderful OA, Al-Anon and AA comedian, but he talks about a friend of his in AA, in OA, who was... He tells it much better than I will. But a friend in OA who could not drink any milk or dairy products. He was allergic to them in a compulsive eater way. And one day he goes to a bar and orders a glass of whiskey. And it occurs to him that if he poured the whiskey, if he poured a glass of the whiskey, he couldn't hurt him on a full stomach. Page 37. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You know, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, right? Albert Einstein did not say that. It appears to have come first in one of the first editions of the book Narcotics Anonymous. Picked up by Alice Walker in one of her books. No one really knows where it started, but that's the first that people have discovered. They go on, they say, you may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched. For this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of them. We've sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences. But there's always the curious mental phenomenon, occurrence for which there is no explanation, that parallel with our sound reasoning, so sort of imagine two parallel lines, there inevitably always ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check, the insane idea won out. And I always think, because I grew up with them, of the Disney cartoons where there was the devil and the angel on either shoulder of Mickey or Goofy or whatever. And I think of sort of the good angel. I'm about to pick up ice cream. The good angel, don't do that. When you do that, you know that you will not be able to stop. And you know all the horrible consequences. You'll gain weight again. You won't be able to do anything. You'll get diabetes. You'll die of blindness. You'll die of gangrene. You'll die of strokes. It will be debilitating. I mean, we should talk about that. I'm not sure I said it all. We are not going to die dramatic deaths from compulsively eating or undereating. We're going to, our bodies are going to shut down slowly. We'll become more and more dependent upon other people. We'll have strokes, we'll have amputations, we'll have blindness. If we undereat, we'll waste away and not get the proper nutrition. We will depend more and more on other people, and we will suffer indignities on the way to an early death. And let's not kid about that. That's what we face. We will break legs and hips and use walkers and ultimately wheelchairs and then electric wheelchairs. That's our fate. And we won't enjoy life, and we will miss our children and our grandchildren or our friends and our loved ones, and that's what's going to happen. We will isolate ourselves with either too much or too little weight. We will obsess about things that will kill us. That's a horrible fate. That's not even as much fun as dying dramatically. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's much worse in its own way. And yet we laugh about food, and we don't laugh about alcohol and drugs. And that's our problem. In a way, somehow we're embarrassed to say that our problem is as serious. And in many ways more, I'm not going to compare. Our problem is as serious as any other addiction. And it ain't funny. And we've got to make that clear. I mean, you're a drinker, AA comes to mind. You're an alcoholic, AA comes to mind. You're a drug addict, NA comes to mind. Or Cocaine's Anonymous, whatever the various drug addiction programs. You're a compulsive eater, a diet comes to mind. And or therapy, or gastric bypass, or whatever, you know. Why doesn't OA come to mind? I think, I'll talk about this more with step 12, I think we're embarrassed to talk about the seriousness of it. I don't think we really look at the seriousness of it in our own way, and we're also not so certain that we have a solution because of all the relapse that occurs within OA. And so we're not sure that the problem is serious, that's step one, and we're not sure that we do have a solution, that's step two. Well, it's pretty hard if you aren't in step one and step two to be able to carry a message of recovery to those who still suffer. So we really have to think about all that. So anyway, so the good angel is saying, don't do this, it's bad for you. I won't do Mickey's voice. Don't do this, it's bad for you, you're going to die, you know, lingering death and all that. And on the other side is the devil. And I don't know about you, but in my experience, that devil, no matter what it says, is essentially saying, come on, have some. It's nothing more and nothing less than that. It may, the big book says in some circumstances we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, and the like. But even in this type of beginning, we're obliged to admit our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient and the like would always happen. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific, meaning horrible, in those days, consequences might be. Think about this. I eat because I'm depressed. Horrible things are going on in my family. Food gives me comfort. I mean, somewhere in my book, I have all the excuses I can think of. I'm sure you can think of your own. I'm depressed. I'm lonely. I'm rejected. Terrible things have happened to me in my life. All the deeply emotional reasons why people think they eat. On the other hand, there's, I'm really happy, I want to celebrate, all the good reasons why people want to eat. And on the other hand, there are things like, oh, it's whole wheat, it's whole grain, it's not, it's natural, it's organic, it was made, it's yogurt made from the milk of yaks blessed by the Dalai Lama, you know what I mean? This cinnamon bun is made from, steel-rolled cut wheat that was grown in a little portion, hand-picked and plucked, and the molasses comes from the residue of the bees that were, royal bees that were fed only organic food, only organic flowers, You know what I'm talking about. I mean, I know that feeling, and there was a time when I was eating these cinnamon buns from an organic bakery. They were light cinnamon buns, and it didn't occur to me for a couple of years to say what makes them light. They used cold pressed oil, and it was whole grain. It's got to be good. They told me, well, instead of using 4 cups of oil, they used 1 cup of oil for 12. That's a lot of oil. It's a lot of fat. I had to stop eating them. I didn't know. I didn't think. I didn't even question. Now I do a lot more questioning. My wife can't stand being in restaurants with me. I think it must be hell for a server to have 6 recovered compulsive eaters. Must be hell. So, that's right. So, you've got this thing of, come on. I mean, that's, it only comes up. I've been good. I've been exercising. I exercise for half an hour so I can eat the cake. I've been good for a year, so I can have some. I've been good for 6 months, so I can have some. I've been good for a month. I've been good for a week. I've been good for a day. I didn't eat the bun, so I can have the cake. Now, that's not just emotional. None of that is emotional. It's insane, but it's not emotional. It's stupid. And I think one of the important things and the distinctions that you'll find sort of in our history and the way we go things, a lot of us, as I've said, and I'm going to be dealing with step 4, have been traumatized as children or have been traumatized as adults. We do suffer. I'm not one of them, but we do suffer. So many of us suffer from real emotional problems and pasts. And we often concentrate on that and think that those are what get us into the food. Those are our reasons. And it is, in a sense, true. Because if you have this addictive reaction in your body, and you're feeling a sense, when you take something in that feeds that addiction, you feel what the doctor called a sense of ease and comfort. You're at home. This, it's momentary, it's fleeting, it doesn't solve the problem, as a matter of fact, it makes it worse. But I understand that. But it's not just emotional. It's also mental. In the broadest sense of the word, from the big book perspective, it's insane. And if you have this image of the devil just saying, come on, okay, right? Okay, maybe it's the third time it's said to you, as it was to Bill, as I talked about today, I guess, with the, come on, Bill, the third time. It's you know, Tennessee Applejack whiskey, you can't get that in this state, okay? It's stupid. It's just, or it's free. Here, boys, have some on me. And there's no reason, and we shouldn't have to figure out why. We just know. Our minds will find any reason whatsoever to do it. Anything that comes to mind that will overcome, because our minds want that stuff. Our minds want us to indulge again. Big book goes on. I'm almost done, and then we'll break. I'll be finished this this chapter really briefly. The jaywalker example on pages 37, 38. The guy gets a thrill out of jaywalking. He keeps doing it. They tell him, you're going to break your hand, you're going to break your legs. He does break his legs. I'm not going to do it anymore. He keeps doing it. And finally, he's in therapy for a long time. He comes out of the hospital, and he breaks his back. And on page 38, they say, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous. Second last paragraph. We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. Next paragraph. Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true. It doesn't fully apply. We have some of these symptoms. We haven't gone all the way. And page 39, you know, the old AA joke about, I know what time it is. I will be finishing within 5 minutes, okay? The old AA joke about the two AA guys who go on a 12-step call, which is something that hardly anyone knows about in OA, but they do that in AA. Someone calls, they go. Two people go up. And they're given this address, an apartment, and the door is open, it swings open, and it's empty, except for a pile of what looks like rags in some part of the apartment. It's filthy, it smells, it's a terrible, awful place. They go up to the pile of rags and realize there's a human being in there. They have no idea what gender it might be or whatever, but there's a human being. Who are you? Oh, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, I'm not that bad. You know? And I remember a conversation I had on the phone with a guy who wouldn't let me visit him. He told me he weighed 425 pounds. And I did everything I could to talk about the allergy, the body, obsession, the mind, et cetera, et cetera. He says, well, you know, thank you. It's very interesting. I said, well, you know, if you're fat as you are and as I was, he says, what makes you think I'm fat? I said, if you weigh 425 pounds, you have to be 10 feet tall to be thin. And he said, oh, I'm not fat. I'm chubby. You know, but I'm not fat. And he died. He died 3 or 4 years later of his illness. So, all right. They go on, page 39. The actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is the point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize. To smash home upon our alcoholics readers, it's been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another example. Jim had a bad day. Fred had a good day. Fred's an accountant. He stops drinking, but he knows it's self-knowledge. He doesn't need the steps. He just knows he doesn't have to drink. Goes to Washington, deals with an accounting issue. Everything goes great. He goes back to his hotel. He dresses for dinner, page 41. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind, it'd be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That's all. And suddenly he's back on a tear. And the big book points out, you can have a good day, you can have a bad day, you can be insane like the jaywalker, you can have been away from it for a long time. If you're a real alcoholic, if you have the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body, you're doomed. And page 43 summarizes it all. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. We'll take a break now, 15 minutes, so that will be 5 after 11. Mm-hmm. and we'll talk about We Agnostics and how it works.